listening to the only daily talk show in North America covering the world of football. This is World Football Daily.
Yes! It hits the back of the net! Oh my goodness me!
The world's game.
Oh, you're beautiful! What a headshot! What a head!
Our religion.
Brilliant goal! What an equalizer!
Our passion.
Go, go, USA! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
World Football Daily serves up the best football talk 5 days a week.
Oh! You will never, ever see a game quite like this! Unbelievable!
They can't be split at the top of La Liga, but it's all smiles for those below them as Atletico and Barca play out a 0-0 draw in the Vicente Calderón, while Real Madrid close the gap to 3 points with their win over Espanyol on Sunday. Sensational City send Pardew into a fit of rage as the Newcastle boss is devastated to see Chiote's incredible strike disallowed at St James's Park on Sunday. And Allegri is out. A 4-3 loss to newly promoted Sassuolo sees the man who was going to be leaving at AC Milan at the end of the season turfed out on his behind from the San Siro, as a miserable year for the Rossoneri continues in 2014. Welcome to World Football Daily. I'm Oliver the Juice Wilson, bringing you the news and the views from around the world of football. Today we are going to be joined a little later on by the legend that is Graham Hunter to talk about all things La Liga from the week, a preview to tonight's Villarreal Real Sociedad game, and of course get his thoughts on who will be winning the Ballon d'Or tonight. That's what the world's media attention is going to be on in the next hour or so, next few hours should I say. It's going to be all kicking off with the Ballon d'Or ceremony. In the meantime, there's plenty to discuss from a weekend of action. Jason Puncheon's free penalty, so should I say, for Crystal Palace against Tottenham. What a miserable strike. Has anybody seen anything worse? Is that worse than the Baggio penalty from World Cup 94? Not as much riding on it, but a disastrous miss, high and wide from 12 yards away. And I'm sure Soldado was watching on and giving him a few pointers just after he missed the man who seems to be an expert for Tottenham from the spot. Tottenham getting that good win against Palace, then 2-0 at White Hart Lane. Manchester United break their losing streak with a 2-0 win over Swansea. United fans, would you have rather that came in the FA Cup, or are you glad to be picking up the 3 points in the league? Is that your bread and butter, as we heard Gordon Hill telling us on Friday last week. Plenty of action to get into as well, but the Bundesliga threw up a few spills. Dortmund having a sketchy time of it at the moment, just 2 wins in their last 5 and falling to Hertha Berlin. We'll touch on that later on in the show as well. But the SAS back in force, that's what I want to talk about at the start of this show today. Suarez and Sturridge back again, combining for goals. Sturridge's assist for Suarez's strike against Stoke on Sunday was sensational. A beautiful little turn and dinked through ball, perfectly weighted with the outside of the boot, whilst he was almost off balance as well, and Suarez providing the cool finish. And Sturridge battling till the last to get his goal, fed in a fantastic save by Jack Butland to deny the initial effort from Sturridge, but retrieving the ball from the byline, taking it 4 yards inside and smashing in at the near post gives Sturridge a goal on a return to the Liverpool starting lineup. Those two are fantastic in form, and they are the reason why Liverpool are still considered title contenders in my eyes for the Premier League crown this year. Without those two, and I really do think if it was only one of them, wouldn't be able to carry the side. But with the pair of them, when one's out, the other one seems to raise their game. When they're both there, they link so well together. It's all going nicely for Liverpool in the first half of the season with those two. And they just have people thinking, what could have happened at Chelsea, for instance? You know, Chelsea are struggling for goals right now. I think it's just eight league goals between Eto'o, Torres and Demba Ba. How much would they have liked Sturridge to have 10 goals down at Stamford Bridge? And they had that opportunity. I always said, you know, Sturridge is a guy that plays down the centre, and it's something that Chelsea really need to look at. They had a quality finisher in their ranks that they just never used. They kept out on the flanks. He showed when he was at Bolton that he could finish and that he was a quality striker, but he was never given that chance really down the centre of the pitch at Stamford Bridge. Moved on, and players were bought in to replace the strikers that were failing at the Bridge, and of course Didier Drogba, who left, and a big disappointment on their part of what could have been. And as well, you know, Torres and Suarez signed on the same deadline day. And you wonder if Chelsea put that money into the Ajax Uruguayan forward and kept Daniel Sturridge, that could have been the 32 goals this season that they could have had down at Stamford Bridge this year, as opposed to at Anfield, where Brendan Rodgers is still bringing on Liverpool nicely in the title race. Is there a better front two at the moment? Negredo and Aguero. Negredo and Dzeko at the moment seem to be firing in goals at the moment. Are they better than the SAS of Sturridge and Suarez? Is Sturridge your number one England striker at the moment, or is Wayne Rooney still deserving to play ahead of him as the front man in England's starting lineup? Your thoughts on the strikers in the Premier League in general, let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 3109098483 is the rant line, the Facebook page as well. Does it also highlight the inadequacies of Manchester United? The fact that, you know, they went and bought Robin van Persie, an injury-prone striker, and he, of course, won them the league last year. But Sturridge, you know, half the value of the majority of the big-name strikers that come into the Premier League, and performing just as well with an exceptional forward, Luis Suarez, playing around him. Is that what Kenny Dalglish wanted to bring in with Suarez and Carroll? Is that Suarez and Sturridge combination exactly what Liverpool need and what teams need in general, and shows that you can still have two strikers up front in the Premier League as opposed to playing three midfielders behind one lone forward? And is it better as well to have two strike partners with such chemistry playing off each other like that? Is it better to have that than to have three players playing behind the one striker? I do quite like the idea of a great 1-2 punch combination up front, and keeping two players forward to support each other rather than one player waiting for three to arrive and kind of calling up the cavalry whenever a team pushes forward. Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 3109098483 is the rant line, the Facebook page as well. Keep your answers coming in and your emails coming in to World Football Daily. We've got a great show coming your way today, and I'm delighted to say that we're kicking off the week with one of the best guests, and he leaves all the rest trailing when it comes to Spanish football journalism. He can only be compared to the Eye of Sauron as he casts his gaze over all things La Liga. Joining us here today is Mr. Graham Hunter. Graham, a pleasure to have you on board, mate. How are you today?
Old and evil, apparently, from the Eye of Sauron. Old and evil.
We would never call you evil by any stretch of the imagination, and we'll keep the old jokes down to a minimum, Graham, today, mate. I hope you are well and enjoyed a thoroughly entertaining weekend of La Liga action. Let's kick it off straight away with the Atletico Barça tie, the top of the table clash from La Liga, finishing in a 0-0 draw. Some may not have seen this one coming. Are you surprised we didn't see any goals in this one, because it seemed to have goals written all over it?
Look, I'd go a different way, Oliver. I really would. I didn't think it had goals written all over it. My tip was 1-1. Now, clearly, we didn't get even that many goals. But if you'd watched closely the Super Cup games, Barcelona couldn't extricate themselves easily from Atletico Madrid. I think probably over the two games, Atletico Madrid had been slightly the better side. I think that we saw in the Cup at the Mestalla last week that Atletico have hit a slight bump in the road. Koke is playing just a little bit more discreetly than he had been. It's now three games in 2014 for Diego Costa without a goal. And there was nothing wrong. There was absolutely nothing to pick at in Atletico's performance against Barcelona. But in the run-up, I was unconvinced that with Messi and Neymar and Alves and Valdes particularly all seeking that spark, that sharpness that repeated training and repeated matches bring you. I thought that it was, for my money, it was always going to be hard to separate the two sides. When you describe Atletico Madrid right now, it would be stupid not to talk about the talent, because they have it, but the go-to description will always be about their pressing and their work rate, their intensity, how difficult they make it for you to be expansive, to unroll your own game against them. That's the starting point of Simeone's coaching, just as it was the starting point of Simeone's play. He was a genuinely good footballer, inspirational, something of a Roy Keane figure, maybe with differences, I accept, but a rallying point, a leader, ferocious, goal scoring from midfield. And he's asked his teams to resemble his own characteristics. And thus, I didn't see Barcelona going there and winning. But I knew from the Barcelona games this season that they were themselves reasonably robust. A little stat was that in all the, now I think 11 games that this referee, Mateo Laoz, has taken charge of Barcelona, it's always been the case that Barcelona have been more fouled, that the opposition team has been given more cards, more fouls against them under Mateo Laoz. And he's booked, I think it's 11 more players and sent off one from the opposition compared to Barcelona stats under him. And in this game, although Barcelona were routinely fouled in order to break up their tempo, which is a Simeone tactic when Atletico play them, Mateo Laoz booked more Barcelona players, 3-2. There were one or two incidents that went away and that Mateo Laoz could easily have maybe given Mascherano a second yellow. He certainly could have booked Arda and Costa. However, Barcelona, the only material point I'm trying to make here is that Barcelona went there and stood up to the physical test. And it is a physical test. And therefore, the excellence, if there was excellence to draw out of it, because I know we all look for goals, I think the excellence would be in the shape for the champions of Mascherano and Piqué. Mascherano had been a real convinced doubter, if you'll allow me that oxymoron, about his position as a centre-half. I think that the ingenuity of Guardiola reinventing Mascherano as a centre-half in the build-up to the 2011 Wembley final has long been overtaken by the fact that he makes repeated mistakes there. His play at the Calderon in the face of a very difficult night from Villa particularly and Costa was intense. Piqué, I think, was even better than him. I think for Atletico Madrid, the thrills were given to us by Arda Turan, who has that, to me, it was given that he was playing wide, it resembled the excellence that Romain Ribéry showed for Bayern Munich against Barcelona last season in the Champions League semi-final, where they skipped past players, where they pushed the full-backs back, where they worked forward, but were terrifically difficult to shake off, playing almost like an auxiliary wing-back as well when Barcelona came forward. Turan showed that mix of no intimidation about Barcelona in front of him, immensely confident on the ball, beating players when he had it, physical players well, a number of the fouls were given against him, but winning the ball back too deep in his own half. And I thought there was excellence to admire in Turan's performance. Overall, clearly, the beneficiaries were Real Madrid.
I was going to ask you who was the main beneficiary, because I can't imagine either side being too disappointed about a 0-0 draw. It means that they haven't dropped points on each other, at least. And also, it's a clean sheet for both when maybe some were, as you say, expecting Barca to possibly stumble at the Vicente Calderon. And equally, Atletico Madrid have got a clean sheet against, yes, without Neymar or Messi in the starting 11, but still a strong Barca attack.
Well, I used the phrase that there's now an outstanding task for one of the league's outstanding coaches, and that Simeone's taken his Atletico team at a time when he's been a trophy winner, where he's materially improved the play, when he's materially improved the squad, when he's imprinted his identity, not just in matches, but in every training session, every day. The work ethic is extremely high. So the outstanding task is to beat Barcelona. They've beaten Madrid twice in two highly significant games, that back-to-back at the Bernabeu between Cup and League. But it's six shots he's taken at Barcelona, and it's three draws and three defeats. So, overall, while it might seem harsh, Atletico Madrid are the least satisfied out of this weekend's business. It was their chance to take a right hook at the champions' jaw. Whether it connected or not, the champions, not only standing, but came out of the Calderon reinforced, because there is no doubt that there's more to come. They say menos to más, from less to more. That's an expression in football in Spain that is used every single day about matches. And it's probably going to be true about Barcelona. Leo Messi says he feels physically fit, has given two cameo performances of note against Getafe and Atletico Madrid since coming back. Neymar missed a couple of training sessions and therefore wasn't sharp enough to start, but finished the season, the winter season, in terrific form. There's much more to come from Dani Alves, who unfortunately for him is suspended from the next league game, but will play tomorrow night in Getafe in the Cup with a 4-0 lead in Barcelona's pocket. And therefore, if you look at the way that Iniesta went off at halftime with bruising on his knee, but seems as if he's going to be fine, you can argue that we're going to see Barcelona's fitness, form, sharpness, creativity and goal power all building towards what are crucial league matches and potentially almost guaranteed a quarter-final of the Cup, but building towards the City tie in the Champions League in the middle of February. Now, Atletico Madrid, they needed to take Barcelona down. They needed to complement their consistency and their ability to win big and go through in the Champions League and win in the league when they're not playing well. They needed to complement that, I think, with a victory over Barcelona by any means whatsoever. One, to establish a gap, but secondly, to convince themselves, the squad, the players. I wrote in August for ESPN that I was absolutely sure that Atletico Madrid were league-winning contenders and that Simeone knew it. We reached the halfway mark and I don't take back a word of it, but they missed a big opportunity. Not just a three-point gap on Barcelona would not have been anywhere near definitive. Psychologically, the understanding, the confirmation that it would have given to members of Simeone's squad, who've never before turned the year as competitors in the Cup, competitors in the Champions League, and competitors right at the top of La Liga. This would have been something like a nutrient, a little football vitamin to take, to ingest, and to benefit from. And therefore, the reason that we both touched on Real Madrid is that when the match finished, Madrid knew that 3 points at Espanyol in Barcelona would set them up within touching distance of the top. One slip and the three-point gap could be closed again. And I think that Real Madrid, given the fact that Real Madrid approached Espanyol's game last night, which I was at and which I found enthralling, really intriguing, given the fact that they've approached that game out of touch and they have been off form, they've looked slightly dyslexic in their passing. Things are not clicking yet. They're carving out wins. They're producing little patches of explosive football. Madrid had to win by hook or by crook. And I spoke to Ancelotti's assistant, Paul Clement, post-match last night about the way in which the team played. And his point of view was that there had been a degree of anxiety, that there had been a realisation that it was of paramount importance to get these goals and to get the goal and the points. And at a time when Gareth Bale is definitely still seeking sharpness, at a time when Xabi Alonso's ear problem has definitely affected his level of control in a match, how he controls the flow of a game, and at a time when Cristiano Ronaldo, just particularly last night, just had all his GSM, all his radar settings were off. Something had knocked the machine and all the settings were an inch or two off. He fired left, he fired the right, hit the goalkeeper from close in. It's one of the most frustrated attitudes I've seen from Ronaldo in many, many years, coming off the back of several games when he's just been firing shots wide. I'm not sure he can fully understand what's going on. And it's a little bit ironic that on the day of the Ballon d'Or awards, Ronaldo, with everybody having said he's had an extraordinary calendar year that we've just left behind, right now he's plumb out of form. And therefore the 1-0 win at Espanyol, even though it would have been frustrating for Madridistas, even though Ancelotti and Florentino Perez would have said, when is the spark, when is the velvet football coming back, when are we going to look convincing? Absolutely nothing else was important other than leaving Barcelona with 3 points. Although Sergio Ramos did point out to me that they're sequentially putting on clean sheets, which the defensive unit always love. But 3 points, that was the be-all and end-all, and they got it. And I think that's a mark of a team that is not out of the race.
I was going to say, if this was in England, I'm sure there would be plenty of people in the papers this morning saying these are the kind of games that when it's not going your way. You still just need to win, and it's a sign that Real Madrid are a big title contender. Would you agree with that statement then, Graham, about Madrid at the moment? And also, just quickly, could you touch on it for us? How impressive Modric was, not just last night, but also he's almost kicked off since that game in the Champions League at Old Trafford against Manchester United. It's rarely seemed to dip from that level of a performance from him. He's gone from kind of zero to hero at Madrid.
Well, if we do the macro rather than the micro, the first thing to say about Real Madrid is that they've got the same question mark hanging over them, I think, that the Barcelona probably do, but maybe to a greater extent, because they are championship contenders. They have a squad which can win this title. They showed in the mid to late autumn that they've also got the football. They've added luster to the squad that started the season, and that Jesse is bursting full of power and confidence and goals, and is an extraordinarily rapid player with and without the ball. And that, when you're bringing in a kid through from the youth ranks, that rallies all the other youth players who think, I can compete for a place. That rallies the fans who say, this is one of ours. The media love it. And it's just a small detail in the fact that there remains quite a lot to be said about Madrid that's positive. However, what's not happening, and has now been the case for four or five games, maybe a little bit more, even including the Cup against Olympic, this Madrid side, yes, carving out the result, marked them as champions, elect champions potentially. The points gap is very low. They've got Barcelona at the Bernabeu in the spring, and they would believe that they played so badly in the home defeat to Atletico Madrid that they go to the Calderon with a chance of overturning it, and with more players in their squad who've been the course before. So they'll look at this points gap today of three and think, we're calm, we're in position, but there needs to be an incremental increase in ruthlessness, in the quality of the passing, in a decrease in the number of chances that they concede. And it was interesting that Ancelotti went to what was very strictly not a 4-2-3-1, which has been his dominant formation for the last 3 months. Certainly since the day that Alonso came back from injury, Madrid have been 99% of the time 4-2-3-1. Last night they were 4-3-3 with the ball, but very markedly 4-4-2 when they didn't have the ball. And the idea there is that because when they play two in midfield and three and then one in front of them, the gaps to either side of, let's say, Alonso and Modric tend to be where teams are putting in a cross into the box from three quarters of the length up the pitch. And Madrid have been very poor at defending that aerially, and therefore going back on what was certainly one of the Cruyff principles in the Dream Team back in the early 90s. If my team is full of small players, I don't want to concede corners or free kicks or crosses from open play. So rather than teaching smaller defenders to jump extraordinary heights that are beyond them, we won't concede free kicks in our half. We won't concede corners, and we won't allow crosses to come in from three quarters of the way up the pitch. And that's what Madrid tried to do. Bale particularly on the right was asked to sit in and not allow there to be a space to the side of the central midfielders. Equally, that was the case on the left-hand side from Ronaldo and then Jesse when he came on. There was a tactical adaptation from Ancelotti which shows that he's not comfortable with the way his team has been playing over the last month. In terms of Modric, I wholly agree. It's been a joy to watch him in that he's now a commanding presence. The footballers around him respect him. They look to him for leadership. While Xabi Alonso still remains probably the second most important player in that squad, because without him, it still comes apart. Ronaldo being the number one. But Modric is very, very intelligently closing that gap in that he gives order, he wins the ball, he uses the ball, he roams forward, he creates at the edge of the penalty box. His striking goal is legendary, and you talked about the turnaround, his performance at Old Trafford, but you know, principally, you were talking about the goal that turned around that tie. I think that, again, it's something that I mentioned to Clement last night, and my point of view was that it's a joy to watch not just the skill, but the intelligence of Luka Modric about it. Now, the Englishman agreed on that point. But I think that his indication was that others need to raise the level to that of Modric at the moment. But he looks majestic, and he looks somebody who will then stay at Madrid, and maybe after the 2 years of Xavi Alonso's contract, which he's just renewed, become the dominant force, become the midfield team leader. And Manchester United had a scout watching room at Espanyol last night. I know from Manchester United players how in Sir Alex Ferguson's, I think, his third last season, but in the summer when Modric signed for Madrid, it was Ferguson's intention to sign him. And the senior players were told by Ferguson, we're getting Modric in the summer. They'll look at him now and think, we wish we had him, because perhaps he's everything at the moment that David Moyes' midfield requires added to it. And he was terrific last night. Made the goal, almost made a second goal from the dead ball situation, but gave authority and control and calm and intelligence and technical class to the Real Madrid midfield. It was lovely, lovely to watch.
A breath of fresh air, Luka Modric at the moment at Real Madrid. Graham, before we let you go, just very briefly, what could be another really entertaining encounter coming up tonight, Villarreal taking on Real Sociedad. Two sides that very similar when you look at, obviously, not only league position in La Liga, but of course, goals conceded, both very strong at the back, especially when you compare them, the only two sides that much greater than them in terms of goals conceded at Barcelona and Atletico Madrid, and similarly banging in a similar number of goals. This is a very close call for me tonight.
No, I agree with you. I think that one of the things that's essential about Villarreal is that they believe that they've overachieved. They knew that they were taking a classy squad out of the Segunda. Getting out, I think they believed right from the outset, was going to be more difficult than making an impact in La Liga, because they'd built deliberately a side which they believed had the quality to be competitive in La Liga. Maybe not to be challenging for Champions League position, which at the moment they still theoretically are challenging for. But if you look at Cani, Bruno, Musacchio, Judo Santos as key examples, and how Trigueros has come on, I think they knew that they had quality to be no worse than mid-table in La Liga by the end of the season. Where they definitely do suffer is that when Gio and Bruno have been out in recent weeks, they've found it difficult to separate themselves from teams, and if they're caught by a sucker punch, it's more likely that they'll drop 2 points or three. And none of the intensity. We neutrals enjoy watching Villarreal because they're front foot. They want to win, but Marcelino has made them a team that, if they're not firing on all cylinders, they still make it very tough to play against them. And I think that Sociedad are probably more full of determining players at the moment, because it began to be a real test for them. I think I don't think that they were particularly well prepared for the Champions League, and that it was hard for them to re-spend the Iaramendi money. Iaramendi had been there, Xabi Alonso, last season in the central midfield. You could see in the Champions League that this sense of when we push the accelerator, when we hold, there was no pause in the game. It was always all-out charge forward, and they were continuously sucker-punched. And I think that was the absolute key. But in that instant, Vela wasn't getting his goals, Griezmann wasn't getting his goals, Agüero's form wasn't what it needed to be after a summertime injury. Seferovic's brilliant goal away at Lyon wasn't being replicated. He wasn't getting any goals at all. And as the Champions League has become something midway through that group, I think they knew they weren't going through. We've seen them rack up more points in that league than they did have last season at the stage under Montagnier. We've seen them playing with much more verve, much more confidence. Physically, they're quite a hard team to play against, in my own personal point of view. Martinez, the fullback, the wingback, is a guy who I enjoy watching playing. Terry Prieto is a tremendously creative footballer. And although I think it's a tough call for a Basque side to travel south on a Monday night to kick off at 9 o'clock, when the world is watching other things, against in a small stadium, which will be compact, which will be relatively hostile, It's a test. It's not Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening at 8. It's not even the 9 o'clock game on Canal Plus. This is one of these games that you could feel like the rest of Spain isn't watching. And if you're not a top pro, you could drop your concentration, turn up at Villarreal, be turned over and be sent back home. there's a very, very big premium that for Jamal Arasate, that he's got his team mentally right, focusing on this as if it was a cup final, focusing on this and saying, these 3 points when you think the world is watching other things, when you, it's cold, when we've had a long journey down. None of the players in Spain are yet used to Monday night football. Monday night football in Gridiron, in the Premier League in England, has been repackaged, it's been understood as something valuable, and it's not yet the case in Spain. So there's, I think that there'll be a test of athleticism at the Madrigal tonight for Real Sociedad, and I think there'll be a test of mentality. If they get both of those right, I think it's feasible that they might come away with 3 points.
It's sure to be a cracking tie tonight, and while everybody else may be focusing on other things around Spain, I know I'm for sure going to be tuning into that one this evening. I can't bring myself to watch Arsenal Aston Villa, Graham, that's for sure. Graham, one word before you go, and it's who's going to win the big golden ball tonight, the Ballon d'Or? Messi, Ronaldo or Ribery?
Yeah, I don't have information to contradict the scores of media around the world and bookmakers who say Ronaldo has won it. I'll say, just as a football lover, not in any way treating as a news story, I have to say that I will be almost equally content if any of these three, for different reasons, were to win it. And I firmly include Leo Messi in that category. Ribery's trophy collection is extraordinary, and his central part in that, in those wins, means that in any other year he'd have merited the Ballon d'Or. I think that if Ronaldo wins it, then I will applaud him. For many years, often on your show, I've said that he's undervalued, that people judge by the cover, not by the book, and that had he not lived in Leo Messi's era, then he would have been not only far more recognised in terms of individual prizes, I think he'd have been far more appreciated. So I'm going into tonight's ceremony, Ollie, completely content that unless a fourth candidate from Guadeloupe suddenly makes it to the podium and lifts the trophy, whichever one of these three men has been voted for by a representative audience of world football, I'll be content. The thing I'm not content with is how the process, the voting, the information process prior to the voting, the extension, all of that was handled ineptly. Other than that, once the football world, via the captains and coaches of international sides and a select band of journalists, has voted, I'll salute the prize.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past Zlatan Ibrahimovic trying to walk up onto that stage before the other three and grabbing that trophy, that's for sure. But
I think you'd be happy with it, yeah.
Part of me kind of hopes that happens as well now. We will wait and see who lifts the Ballon d'Or this evening. But Graham, an absolute pleasure to chat with you. I know you've got a slight ticky throat, I've been told today. So I appreciate you taking the time out and spending far too much of your good time with us as well, mate. We really appreciate it.
Been a pleasure. Enjoy your football.
You too, Graham. Graham Hunter there joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things Spanish football, and what that man doesn't know about Spanish football isn't worth knowing, as we ran through Barca and Atletico Madrid and that 0-0 draw on the weekend, and of course Real Madrid as well. Graham, one of our favourite guests to have on, and a fantastic author, a fantastic speaker, and just a fantastic brain of Spanish football, and of course the Ballon d'Or as well. That would be something, wouldn't it? Zlatan walking up to onto the stage and playing keepy up with it. We will see what happens this evening, just a few hours away from the Ballon d'Or announcement. Big thank you, as always, there to Graham Hunter, the man, the myth. Well, I suppose he's not really a myth, but definitely a legend, joining us here on World Football Daily, taking us through the big games from La Liga. An unspectacular win for Real Madrid. Cristiano Ronaldo not putting in that final blasting performance as we approach Ballon d'Or deadline day tonight. Who does your vote go to? We got Graham's thoughts. Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter, 310-909-8483 is their antline, and the Facebook page as well. Should it be Messi? Should it be Ronaldo? Should it be Ribery? Should Zlatan or Suarez have been involved in that top three as well? Let us know your thoughts. Joining me as always is Rafa. Rafa, mate, how was your fine weekend? I hope it was a happy one, a slightly happier one than mine. I'll get into the details of mine in just a moment. But yeah, how was your weekend, mate?
It was very productive, Juice. Very productive. I stayed busy, and I caught a lot of football at the same time. So, you know, I'm excited to kind of talk about this. I'm currently joining you from my new office in my house. So apologies if there's any kind of sound issues for today. Hopefully we'll get them sorted out tonight, if not definitely before tomorrow's show and recording. So, again, apologies about that, but really excited about the football.
Mate, it was a cracking weekend of games. And I want to first get, because I've noticed, I checked our World Football Daily IKTS League, and I'm telling you right now, almost everybody has smashed it out of the park. I don't know why, but this appeared to be one of the easiest weekends to predict. As the scores were coming through, I knew exactly what I predicted, and I knew that had I put like a £1 bet on the Saturday Premier League fixtures, not the scores, obviously, but just the winners and losers, I put that bet on, I could have been in for 120 quid this weekend, because I got every single Premier League fixture in terms of draw, winner and loser correct. And I was so gutted, because I don't really normally put on any kind of bets or anything like that. I'm not a big gambling man. I've got plenty of friends that do these kind of accumulators. And yeah, the one, had I done it this week, I could have been in with a little bit of extra cash, which would have been grand. Why was it so easy to predict this week? I mean, was it form? Obviously, some of the ties were relatively easy to look at. As we were saying last week, you know, you kind of knew Chelsea would beat Hull, Everton to beat Norwich, of course. But there was, Tottenham to beat Crystal Palace. But there were things like Southampton and West Brom. Some people were kind of either or on that one, didn't know which way to go with it. Similarly, Sunderland, Fulham, that could have gone either way. I was reasonably confident that Sunderland would pull out the bag, but that easily could have gone Fulham's way down at Craven Cottage. In fact, that game didn't go easily for Fulham at all, and they were torn apart by either rejuvenated looking Sunderland side or a disastrous Fulham performance. Have your say on that one. And similarly, Liverpool against Stoke, that turned out to be a lot closer than I think some of us thought it would be, although Liverpool do have this torrid run of three losses in a row at the Britannia until Sunday. But fantastic performance once again. The SAS are back as well. There's plenty of football to get to from England. There's plenty of football to get into, of course. As we said earlier in the start of the show, Allegri sacked from AC Milan today after, quite frankly, an embarrassment against Sassuolo in Serie A on Sunday. Raf, I don't know if you were just laughing. I noticed today that you haven't jumped in straight away to kind of rub it in. And I suppose you can't to an extent, because I'm still riding away from Saturday's Sheffield Wednesday win against Dirty Leeds 6-0 in the Championship early kickoff. But Berardi's four strikes against Milan after they went 2-0 up inside 15 minutes and looked to be cruising against the newly promoted side. And suddenly Sassuolo come back. Inter Milan battered these guys, 7-0 earlier on in the season in Sassuolo. How did Milan do this, Ram? I'm getting beyond the kind of realms of thought of how bad this Milan side can play at points. And Sassuolo, in fairness, have raised their game. And Berardi had a very, obviously, very, very good performance. But there are question marks, especially around that second goal, the judgment of I think it was Zapata. No, it was Boniero, actually, who misjudged the bounce of the ball and then doesn't do enough to get his body in the way of the strike, and beating Abbiati at the near post as well from a volley on the turn. Very disappointing indeed. It's just awful for Milan right now. Absolutely awful.
Sure. To me, Juice, and I actually did get to watch this game. Here was my issue. They're unmotivated, unfocused, and that's how you let a Sassuolo come back from down to kind of bite you in your ass. That should never happen. A well-disciplined, a well-drilled team, a well-managed team, just not only keeps that lead and doesn't let anything through, but builds from there. And it's obviously that, or it's obvious that they have the talent. If you look at the squad, the names in that squad are very, very gifted players, Juice. I know you have to agree with me on that one. The fact that they scored four goals, it speaks to that itself. But the sad fact that they can't, hold, or three goals, I'm sorry. The fact that they can't hold a Sassuolo attack is just beyond me. It's completely out of character for Milan as a club, and it's seriously embarrassing. And I don't want to drill you down, Juice. I know what it's like to be down as a football supporter. Trust me, I know how it feels to go down. But I just know that you yourself are probably just as disappointed and embarrassed at just the play that your team put out on the field that day.
Well, you talk about kind of the defense and the back four pairing in the centre back positions of Zapata and Bunyera. You compare that to the great Milan defenses over the last few decades or so. You know, Baresi, Nesta, Maldini, these iconic centre backs who could pretty much repel anything that came near them. Yep, Stam, of course, getting involved in that as well. Zapata and Bunyera. Bunyera, I used to really rate. I really did used to think that he and kind of Nesta as a back two would be the next dynamic duo for Milan when Bunyera started coming through. And I don't think he's kind of lived up to that potential that many people thought he had. And Zapata had an absolute shocker, and he's not been great this season in general. I mean, you talk about this Milan side having quality, right? I mean, Balotelli, obviously. Kaká is a fading star. Let's not beat around the bush. I still think he can put in great performances and very good performances, but I also accept that this is not the same Kaká of days gone by at Milan. Robinho has always frustrated me with laziness. Nocerino, I haven't seen play well in a Milan shirt for a long time now. National team, he did well, especially at the Euros in 2012, but I don't see that player for Milan at the moment. Nigel de Jong, I mean, Man City reject because he wasn't good enough to play that holding midfield role ahead of Gareth Barry. You know, it just shows that De Jong's not the player that he was or could be. I don't rate this Milan side that highly. Abbiati as well, very, you know, getting into his elder years, and I would still be looking for a new keeper as well if I was AC Milan. Now the question is, of course, who comes in and replaces Allegri? He's sacked today by Milan after that shocking loss. And it's going to be a tough one because I don't know if there are many people that will want the job. I don't like the idea of Seedorf coming in now. Apparently Botafogo are going to kind of say if he wants to go, he can go. I don't like that idea because it's an ex-player, inexperienced as a manager, coming back to coach a former side. And it could taint his reputation at the club. It's going to be a very difficult job for him to do anything with it. And I don't see, whatever Milan fans would say, I don't see them being kind of tolerant of results like this continuing, even if it is an inexperienced manager like Seedorf coming in. But I don't know who else would want to come in who could really turn this Milan side around, because it's just not good enough at the moment, Raf. It made very disappointing reading. I want to thank Gio as well, the editor of the worldfootballdaily.com Kickabout, who was, you know, very kind to me by sending me a text saying, hey, Juice, have you ever heard of this kid, Bernardi? Have you ever heard of him? And I was like, oh, thanks very much, Gio. Appreciate it. So much there. You know, don't text me again like that.
Don't ever text me again.
But seriously, Gio, don't ever text me stuff like that again. No, it was a big downer, and I was quite pleased that I had the playoffs to kind of flick across to when things started to go badly for Milan in that game, because it was difficult to watch. You know, it was like watching a player get their leg broken. Just difficult to watch. You can't stay and watch the car crash for too much longer. But problems with AC Milan, how can they solve them without that transfer budget? Let's know your thoughts. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter, 310-909-8483 is the rant line, the Facebook page as well. Is this Milan side good enough, or are they and they're just underperforming, or is this a poor Milan side? I'd love to know the answer and your thoughts to that question. Raf, it was also confirmed over the weekend, Defoe and Bradley, and they're definitely going, etc, etc. And Jermaine Defoe's popping up for Tottenham this weekend and scoring in their 2-0 win over Crystal Palace. I mean, he's going to be sticking around until, you know, the end of February before heading off to Toronto. Do you think that's a smart idea? And obviously it's good for Tottenham. It means they've still got Defoe as cover in the early parts of 2014. But for Toronto, it must be a bit disappointing, you think, for them, because they'd want to get Defoe into their squad, into their fold early on for training. And, you know, he's a great player, and I think he is going to shine in Major League Soccer, regardless of what anybody else says. And I think he will be able to bang in the goals and do a very good job for Toronto. But you'd want him in that fold early on, just to get him settled into the new surroundings and get him training with the team, and maybe start to create a bit of a partnership with his midfield and get that kind of chemistry going nice and early before the season kicks off. Because you don't really want him coming in, you know, completely dry, completely barren in terms of a relationship with the players that he's playing with. He'll only have a few weeks before the season starts in March.
Look, to be honest, Jesus, I hate to disagree with you, but...
Disagree away, my friend. Disagree.
Yeah,
away.
No, I kind of feel like this might be a good thing for him, because I don't see Sherwood or Tottenham kind of abusing Defoe, really, because you just can't. You can't really start Defoe and have him play a full 90 minutes back to back. It's just not what you're going to get from
him. Well, he's not going to outplace Adebayor or Soldado anyway. So,
no, not at all. But again, he is such an interesting change of play, change of tactics, even a different style that comes onto the field once he comes on. That it does offer up a different kind or a different attack for Tottenham right now. It's a fantastic bench player if you think about it, and for Defoe, really. I mean, I think he could kind of keep this or utilize this and maximize that last bit of, you know, top level play that he can, you know, hopefully kind of stay at that level at the highest level as long as he can, and bring as much of that over and translate it into the MLS season as possible. I think that's possible. I definitely think that's possible.
It's important for Defoe to get some game time still at Tottenham if he is going to be there, just to keep himself sharp. You know, if he is going to be there until February, Toronto will want Sherwood to play him, you know, as they did this weekend, in bits and parts, get him, keep him match fitness tweaked and ready for entering the Major League Soccer season right at the beginning and hit the ground running straight from the get-go. As you say, there's, you know, the problem of if he plays too much. I don't think Sherwood will do that, but at the same time, if he does pick up an injury or something like that, it could be disastrous for Toronto, which is almost why I think rather than leaving it in Tottenham's hands almost, Toronto are better off getting Defoe, or would have been better off getting Defoe in as soon as possible over to Canada and getting him playing in their preseason training and getting him used to their fitness regime and getting him ready for the season, as opposed to relying on Tottenham to keep him ready, primed and prepped to come across. But I can see where you're coming from with that. I just think Toronto would have been smarter to have it have it their way, almost, sure, so to speak. I was lucky enough, by the way, Raf, I tell you, on my weekend to have caught about, I did three games of football, right? So this is my Saturday. Friday night, I did some Ligue 2 commentary and everything went well. And I was doing two games on the Saturday. I was primed and prepped and ready for all that. And I just had to finish off the last couple of bits of preparation. So when I got back at about 9:30, 10 o'clock on Friday night, I was going to finish off my prep for the two games on the Saturday. Bish, bash, bosh, all good, very sorted. And this is how my weekend was such a kind of roller coaster ride in this point, then, because I got a phone call on the Friday night saying, hey, you know, you've got these two games on Saturday. Can we give you another one to cover in between those two? So I was like, yeah, you know, work's good. I want work. Let's keep rocking with getting more work and getting more commentary and watching football in general. So I was lucky enough to be able to do three games on the Saturday, a 1 o'clock kickoff, a 3:15 kickoff and a 5:30 kickoff, which pretty much plays perfectly into the schedule, you know, 2 hours and then a 15-minute break in between, about, well, 15, 20-minute break in between to get yourself sorted for the next game. So Friday night, I ended up being up late doing my prep for the third Saturday game that I've been given and finishing off the prep for my other game.
Was this also a league to a game? Or
No, this was a Greek Super League. So it kicked off on Saturday, 1 o'clock, with Angers against Nancy. A big Ligue 2 clash, actually. Unfortunately, it was a very disappointing game indeed. Finished up 1-1. Then 20 minutes or so break, moved into the Greek Super League clash of Levadiakos against Ergotelis. Not a great game, two poor sides, and to be honest, a very disappointing match to watch from a viewing entertainment's point of view. During the Angers-Nancy game, and a little bit of a lap over into the Levadiakos-Ergotelis game, I was able to catch some of the Sheffield Wednesday match. Obviously, I wasn't able to watch it live, but was listening to the Spanish commentator in the booth next to me just going, "Gol, gol, 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 gol! Sheffield Wednesday!" about six times or so in that game, which was obviously very pleasing indeed. And sure. In the gap between the Levadiakos-Ergotelis game and the Panathinaikos-Panionios game, Athenian derby, by the way, I went over to our shift coordinator and said to him, "Hey, man, you know, this is a great day. This is a fantastic day. You know, I got work yesterday, got prepped and sorted and have come down here still all good with three games to do, three games back to back. And I managed to catch a little bit of Sheffield Wednesday beating Leeds 6-0. I mean, the only thing that could ruin this day now is something like my car breaking down on the way home or something. So I did the Panathinaikos Panionios game. Panathinaikos lucky to come away with a result in that one. A chap called Lansik, right? Substitute comes on for Panionios. Lansik comes on, Panionios win a penalty. Lancic's been on the pitch for about 2 minutes, if that. Walks over to the captain, strips the ball out of the captain's arm and said, I'm having this, me, all about me, real. He's one of these guys that looks like a bit of a prima donna. He's got like a half-shaved head on the left side of his head with then his hair combed over to the right side dyed. And you know what, just the kind of guy you look at and you think, oh, come on, mate, yeah, don't be like that. And he makes a song and dance about taking the penalty, steps up, hits the post, ball bounces away. Panionios end up losing 1-0 against Panathinaikos. Yeah, really, like, nothing like being Captain Dick almost kind of thing, making a fuss about it. So that game finishes far more entertaining.
Hold on, real quick, before you get too far ahead. Is that miss worse than the punching miss from Crystal Palace?
No. We'll get onto punching's penalty in just a second, because that, you know, there are field goal kickers that be disappointed with that miss kind of thing, and they're trying to get it that high. And then Panathinaikos Panionios finishes. I'm like, great, let's get rolling. I pull out of the car park at work and start to drive down a motorway down the M3, which I have to take a little bit on and then drive around another motorway down back home. It's about a 40-minute journey from here to work. And suddenly the battery lights on my car is on. I'm like, oh, that's not great. But, you know, it'll recharge itself while I'm driving. It's a good 40-mile drive back. Yeah, it'd be all right. Then the power steering kind of cuts out for a moment. I'm like, oh, this isn't great. No. I'm overtaking somebody on the M3, and suddenly the power steering goes. All the lights on my dashboard kind of start bleeping and bling, bing, 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 bing. The car's making weird noises. I'm just like, okay, so I'm doing like 80 mile an hour whilst this is happening on the motorway. Well, let's 70 mile an hour actually, but let's kind of not mess about with this. I have to pull across three lanes of traffic into the hard shoulder with no power steering. Crack the hazard lights on. Call the freaking breakdown crew who tell me I've got like an hour and a half wait. It's about about two degrees. I'm sat on the side of the road behind the barrier, well away from the car, just in case there's any instance, of course, being safe. Hazard lights are on, but all the other lights in my car are starting to fade and go out. Stood there an hour and a half waiting, another half hour to get the car up on the truck. I get towed home, drop almost like another 20 minutes to get the car off the tow truck and fill out all the paperwork and get sorted. Just after I'd said to the guy, what a great weekend. The only thing that could ruin this is my car breaking down, and the bloody car breaks down on the way home, mate. And then on Sunday, Milan get battered as well. It's just the weekend started so well, and then just from about 8 o'clock in the evening on Saturday, just nosedive into a terrible disaster. Not good at all.
You almost sound like a drug addict, man, who had a super nice high at the beginning of like a weekend and just crashed the rest. I'm sorry. I feel bad for you, man.
Absolute disaster. I mean, the only thing that kind of made up for it was watching Alan Pardew get so irate, because I thought, well, at least I'm not as angry as this guy on Sunday. I mean, there's no interference from Newcastle players in that goal, right? Is there? A strike, by the way, from Tiote. I mean, we've seen him banging a couple before, including that one in the 4-4 draw against Arsenal not so long ago, a few years back. But that is a hell of a strike. It's about 100 mile an hour going past Joe Hart. And Hart has the audacity to say, oh, I couldn't see anything. You couldn't see anything because it was a wall of blue shirts in front of you. You know, Gouffran's doing nothing. He's not in the way of Hart's vision. He's not blocking Hart from getting across to the ball. He's away from the play. He's moved out of the way. If the ball had gone around him, I could argue it. But the ball's gone inside of him between he and Joe Hart. So it's not like Gouffran's blocked the vision in any way, shape or form of that strike. Wonder goal. Newcastle, very unlucky not to be given that. And Pardew, kind of right to be irate. He gets angry though, doesn't he, Alan Pardew? I mean, he's got anger issues, this guy, hasn't he?
Yeah. Well, and to be honest, I kind of feel like that only made the situation worse, because it kind of trickled on down to the field and to his players. I mean, I thought Kabay kind of, when the incident happened, you kind of see Kabay walk up calmly to the referee, hands behind his back, almost gently talking to this guy, trying to plead his case and say, you know, you must be having a laugh, like, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, as soon as kind of Pardew just goes irate, you know, you see Kabay kind of throwing in all these crazy tackles. You know, he gets and his teammates, you know, they get carded. I think there's four Newcastle cards to two from City. it looked like Newcastle kind of lost it a little bit on the field.
Falling apart at the seams, really, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, and it was kind of upsetting to, I think, the neutral, because for all intents and purposes, it was a really entertaining game. And you would like to think, I mean, I don't know about you, Juice, but I like to think that if you give Newcastle that goal, that might even spurn, Man City to kind of really turn up a notch. And we could have seen another 3 or 4 goals from Man City just to get back at Newcastle for letting in that goal. I seriously believe that.
Yeah, and still the comfy 2-0 win overall, I think, for City, and showing their form on the road is now completely changed. They're in a whirlwind kind of run of form at this point, and I can't see anybody beating them to the title at the moment. Chelsea.
It feels like Pellegrini definitely has this team kind of clicking on all cylinders and on the same page, really. You know, or sipping his Kool-Aid.
It looks like they're a side that are motivated to almost go for the jugular. You know, they're not happy with just a 1-0 win, like we've seen with maybe Mourinho's Chelsea sides, and possibly we've seen on a few occasions with his side this year. You know, not happy with just sitting back on a 1-2-0 win. You know, City go at sides and get aggressive. I mean, especially at home, but now away from home as well. They get aggressive in terms of wanting to kill games off comfortably. And you've got to respect them for that. And it's a much more enjoyable way to watch football being played, seeing a side that just, all right, well, we're going to go and try and get 6-7 past you.
Quick question for you, man. Do you think, do you make anything of the fact that, like, I mean, I don't really hear anything of it, but the fact that there's no real discussion about the keeper kind of play, you know, like the way that he's kind of using Hart and Pantilimon, I don't see anybody questioning it, and I don't see anybody kind of, you know, concerned about the way he's using them. And to be honest, I'm impressed. I think that both keepers are kind of on their toes and looking to perform at their peak every time they're given the opportunity.
Well, we've seen Real Madrid do a similar thing with Lopez and Casillas, you know, rotating them around, moving them around, having one for cups and one for leagues. And we've seen United do it in the past as well. De Gea and Lindegaard have rotated around for cups and league matches and whatnot. So it's pretty similar. And if it keeps them both on their toes and playing good football and it's working at the moment and they're keeping clean sheets, especially on the road, why not leave it like that? Because if it's getting the best out of the players, whatever it takes to get the best out of the players, do it. And they're both two keepers that have had good performances this year and had pretty awful performances at points as well. And if he's found a way to keep them playing, keep them motivated and keep them on the top of their game, then why change anything around at the moment? I don't mind it. And I think while it works, then nobody will raise any questions about it. If it does start to break down, then there will be people immediately on the, oh, why are you rotating them? Why do you? But until that point, you know, they're still in the League Cup, they're still in the FA Cup, they're still in the Champions League, and they're top of the table at the moment in the Premier League. Man City are at the moment on Dream Street, and they've got a serious chance of being able to get past Barca when the Champions League comes back around in February. We'll talk about that, of course, when it comes around towards middle and end of February. Some surprising results elsewhere around Europe as well. Quick kind of wrap-up of some of the results that have caught our eye. I think we were all a little bit taken aback by Borussia Dortmund falling to Hertha Berlin, and Dortmund in a difficult run of form at the moment. I know the defensive injuries aren't helping in any way, shape or form. And when you've got a back four of Durm, Papastathopoulos, I think I got that right, but I don't know, Saar and Grobkroot, it's nowhere near as strong as we've seen Dortmund's defensive line in the past, but still struggling to win at home against Hertha Berlin. A bit of a shock coming from the Bundesliga this weekend. We've obviously talked about the Milan result, and I don't, yeah, if we could just avoid that one.
No problem.
Fiorentina as well, though, drawing with Torino. I know Torino having a good season, but you would have hoped that Fiorentina, with the kind of attacking forces they've got at the moment, would have been able to get past Torino away from home, and a 0-0 clean sheet, obviously still positive result for Fiorentina to take. But I just wonder if some of their fans might be a little bit disappointed that those are the kind of games that they need to be winning if they are going to be considered a kind of a serious title challenger. And then Estoril drawing with Sporting Lisbon. We were chatting with Tom Kunder last week about Liga Sagres and how entertaining and interesting it is. Estoril getting a 0-0 draw against Sporting Lisbon, a second place, first place played fourth place in Liga Sagres, and that gave Benfica the opportunity to go to the top of Liga Sagres table and finally open up a gap over Sporting and Porto with their 2-0 win over Porto in the Stadio de Luz on Sunday afternoon, and a very well-observed minute silence as well for Eusebio before that game. And Gio was telling me how the game, both the game was extremely entertaining, and of course the kind of atmosphere surrounding it as well. He was able to catch it on television. Unfortunately, we don't really get any coverage of Portuguese football over here in the UK, so I wasn't able to see any of it, which is a bit of a bugger, I have to say, Raf, as to put it in a nice British phrase for you. It's a bit of a bugger, that one, Raf.
Sure, sure. But I'm interested to see what kind of cable package Gio has, because I don't have that channel, whatever channel he's watching. Or maybe I do. I don't know.
I wonder if he's illegally streaming.
Yeah. I knew that you were, I know that we had Graham Hunter on the show and everything like that, and I know you covered this already, but I want to get your opinion on it. Who was the draw bigger for, Atletico Madrid or Barcelona?
To be honest, everybody wins in this situation to me. I spoke with a friend about it on Saturday night. Everybody wins. It's a great result, I think, for Atletico, because it shows that they can mix it up with Barca at the top of the table and hold Barca to a clean sheet. Barca get a point on the road against a very strong Atletico Madrid side that people have to look at differently in this season. And it's a positive for Real Madrid as well, because both sides drop points, and Madrid just able to get past Espanyol in a comfortable 1-0 win on the road. And that means they get to close the gap on these two up at the top of the table. Now we're just within 3 points of both Barca and Atletico. So there really is almost... there's no big loser. There's no Madrid, arguably the big winner, but there's no real loser, I think, from that result. You know, I think both sides will be happy to have kept clean sheets and to have got a point away from that one, if anything else. So I don't see it being too much of a problem. I think Diego Simeone will be chuffed with that and be continuing the quality work that he does at Atletico. Rafa also asked Graham this, and you need to put your vote in now. Obviously, we didn't get an official vote on this, but tonight is the big Ballon d'Or ceremony.
Oh yes, oh yes.
So, who is it? Is it Ribery? Is it Ronaldo? Is it Messi? Or should it have been none of the above?
No, I'm going to give it to Ronaldo, and I think the last time you kind of asked me, I gave it to Ronaldo.
You haven't changed your tune then?
Yeah, no, I'm not going to change it. I will say this, that I am kind of pulling for Ribery, only because, you know, and he said it himself, this is probably the last time he'll ever really have an opportunity to win this. And for what he accomplished, you know, kind of in the last year with club and country, he excelled on all platforms for me. But Ronaldo has just, you know, I think last year not winning it kind of lit a little bit of a fire under his ass to just want to make sure he did enough. And for me, you know, the goals that he scored, the way that he's essentially been shouldering both his club and his country and literally putting his country on the back to qualify for the World Cup. I know that that's, you know, kind of shady area considering whether or not that was part of the Ballon d'Or season or not, but whatever. I just think that he has done it for me this year, and I think he deserves it.
Do you get the feeling with Ribery, though, that there was almost like Bayern won, you know, the treble?
Yeah.
And we have to choose somebody from Bayern almost, because and don't get me wrong, I thought Ribery was fantastic last year. You know, not the goal scorer like Ronaldo and Messi, but you know, his play, he was probably the most on form player last season in European football, you know, by the performances that he put in. But some people will say, you know, maybe Zlatan or Suarez, especially with the season he's having right now, and we spoke about the SAS in the beginning of the show, should have been given their opportunity maybe ahead of Ribery, because they've been more important individual players as opposed to Ribery, who was very much in a massive team effort that that won those games. And you can argue that with Messi as well over the last few years, or maybe not the kind of last season, though, in the most recent seasons, because of how he has held that Barca side at some points together and how they look to him so much now. But do you buy that? Do you think there were other candidates that should have been in instead of Ribery? Or do you think it was a case of Ribery was picked because, we've got to have somebody from that Bayern side? Ribery was the best player in that Bayern side. We'll have him in our top three.
Well, here's the thing with that argument, and I get it completely, because Bayern did just do so much that there should have been someone that should be maybe representing that team, that club, and that success on the Ballon d'Or ballot. Does he deserve to be third? Does he particularly deserve to be third? That is an interesting argument. I don't know, man. To me, it really is a two-horse race. You can make a lot of arguments for a lot of different people, but at the same time, with those same people, like with your Zlatan Ibrahimovic, my kind of top pick for an argument to replace Ribery, you can look at all that he did for his club and his country, and you can almost say that he fell a little bit short with Sweden. He obviously is the best player on that team, but And he is the same style of player in terms of, being the entire or the person that the rest of the team is built around at PSG. But at the same time, PSG's success last year, although fantastic and immense and great, not the same as Bayern Munich, not the same as other teams. So there's your argument there. And that's why I think that this third place kind of position, or the third spot, the third pick, to be the finalist, is kind of very arguable and up in the air. But for me, it's also almost a tier or a step below Messi and Ronaldo at this point.
It's an argument that will be continued, I'm sure, well after the voting process and the results are announced tonight, this afternoon.
Oh, real quick, I'm sorry. With the Ribery thing, the other thing that really kind of tears him down is the fact that it really was a team effort with Bayern Munich. I mean, they were such a fantastic team. It is very, very difficult to just pick one, because if you look at Ribery, you also want to look at Robben and what he did, and this again, the names that come off that team are incredible, but it's also a very, very solid team effort. And that's why I think it's also going to be kind of taking away from Ribery. There was such a fantastic supporting cast around him. There's just no way that he's going to get that kind of individual accolades.
Yeah, Messi's got that fantastic supporting cast too, as I say. But I do see what you saying
but,
about
but
that.
Messi
it's not
puts
like
in goals.
I was going to say it's
yeah.
But Ribery provides the assists. So
sure,
I mean,
sure.
he created so many of those goals for Bayern last year, and it will be, as I say, a debate that will continue well after
fantastic
the announcement
player.
Of...
I'm not trying to take away from him, but just a different level. And again, surrounded by just incredible class. And it shows by the five trophies that they won in one calendar season.
Let us know your thoughts. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter. Who deserves to be picking up that Ballon d'Or trophy tonight? And will there be a new boot out for Lionel Messi should he win another one? Or will Nike have a boot in store for Cristiano Ronaldo? I heard a very interesting fact the other day was that Zidane... I think there's a rumour that Zidane basically, when he got when he headbutted Materazzi and got sent off, that World Cup final, obviously he was going to be retiring anyway after that. And... Adidas have prepared these brand new gold boots to present to Zidane once he retired, and they never got presented to him because of the way that he retired from the game, obviously after the headbutt with Materazzi. I'd love to see if there's any truth in that. We will try and get onto Adidas at some point, but everybody gets new boots when they do something in football. I scored a goal the other week in football. I don't get a pair of new boots. I barely get a round of applause these days. We will leave it there here on Monday's edition of the show. Arsenal taking on Aston Villa tonight. Villarreal taking on Real Sociedad as well. Some football to keep us going as we start the week off here on World Football Daily. A big thanks to everybody who joined us today, including Graham Hunter and, of course, the big man Rafa. A big thanks to all you guys for listening as well. Sampdoria take on Udinese and Inter taking on Chievo as well. I just hope Inter stumble like Milan stumbled this week. And yes, sour grapes, very much the taste of the day for me. We will be back at the same time tomorrow as always. And remember, keep emailing us and tweeting us. Show at worldfootballdaily.com and at WFootballDaily on Twitter. And we will see you at the same time on Tuesday to look back at where the Gunners can go back to the top of the Premier League.